Power Hour. Welcome.
And a happy Saturday to you. Power Hour 257 is going to go in the books here for a second. Let me get rid of this share here. Just for a minute. And we're live here from Miami Beach, and I think Rod's in California is our guest speaker today. And we're going to take it right up to the top of the next hour. We started a little bit earlier today than normal, but that's okay. And Rod's been around this business for a long time. He's an author. He put a lot of courseware. He's made a lot of stuff. He's like, we're kind of like, I don't know. I create a lot of stuff. He creates a lot of stuff. There's a few of us who can do that. He's one of them, and he's been around for quite a long time. And we had the same aerobatics instructor. I don't know if he was, but it was same Amelia Reed. She was one of the first women air show pilots. Great lady. She told me two things. I have to tell Rod for a second. She told me, she had a master's in math, and she also played for the violin in the San Jose Symphony. And she said to me, she goes, "You know what I'm most proud of?" And I said, "No." She said that I outlived both of my husbands. That's what she said. She was fiery. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, Rod is here. He's going to take us off and talk about landings, a really big topic. And we're going to see what he has to say about it. He's got a lot to say. And so anyway, you probably know him already. But anyway, he's going to talk about that. And I'm going to let him do that. So I'm done. Say what you like, Rod.
Thank you very much, Mike. And it's a real pleasure being here, and thank you so much for inviting me. And yes, we did have the same aerobatic instructor, Amelia Reed, and but actually she was my primary instructor back in 1970-71, and one of them, and it was one of the best educations I've ever had, quite frankly. It's interesting that the school, Amelia Reed Aviation at that time, was populated by a lot of people that were first-generation instructors that were taught by World War II instructors. And in fact, there were two female WASP instructors there, too. So you're learning stick and rudder skills in a way that they were originally taught. Let's put it this way. These were the stick and rudder skills needed to survive in an airplane, not pass a check ride. So it was quite an interesting experience, and those lessons just stuck with me. They were so powerful, and it was one of the best experiences I've ever had. So with that in mind, and Mike, I assume you can see my screen. Is that correct?
No, I don't see. I just see you.
Okay, great. Let me go ahead and share the screen here. Stand by. Here we go. Very good.
Okay, yep, we see it now.
Got it. Excellent. And feel free to give me any feedback there, Mike, if it's not showing what I want to show. So we're going to talk today about a perspective on teaching students to land. And after having been an instructor now for 52 years, flying for about 54, actually 55, it's good to have gotten this old. You learn quite a few things, and flying's been my passion. It's been my life. Landings has always been an experience an interesting thing for me, because I've always been fascinated as to why it takes some people so long to land. It's an interesting thing to explore. So let me begin by saying that there's more than one way to fly an airplane. And sometimes we pilots get caught in this ideological trap that, hey, there's only one way to fly the airplane. If you're going to trim an airplane, you got to do it this way. If you're going to go around, you got to do it this way. And that's, you know, kind of like believing that Caligula was a new way of learning how to write instead of being a Roman emperor, a failed one at that. But the essence here is that as flight instructors, we have to keep an open mind. And the first thing we have to keep an open mind on is, in particular when it comes to landing, is this idea that there's a difference between technique and procedure. And that is so fundamental, in my opinion, to helping all flight instructors keep an open mind. For instance, pitch, power, airspeed, throttle, aircraft control arrangement. That's fascinating because, you see, the reason we argue about that so much, and boy, we do spill a lot of figurative blood, so to speak, in arguing about, you know, the pitch power technique. And the reason we do that is simply because we fail to understand the distinction between pitch. I'm sorry, between technique and procedure. You see, the procedure is before you land, you put the gear down. Where you put the gear down, downwind, base, final, approaching the airport, before you intercept the ILS, before you the glide slope, before you start down. The deal there is that's a procedure. You always got to put the gear down before you land. The technique, however, when and where you put the gear down is a matter, again, of technique. So there's a big difference, and that'll be important later on in this discussion. And I thought I'd start off with this one point, and I'll expand on this more later. A friend of mine was teaching out at Edwards Air Force Base at the Explorer Camp during the summer. We'd go out there, and we would teach students, high school students, give them 10 hours of flight time and teach them ground school. And they would, many of them would solo. In fact, almost all of them soloed. And he discovered an interesting thing. And this is not an official study, but I believe the anecdotal information really makes a powerful point. And that is, he told me that he found that when he taught in the J3 Cub, where they didn't use headsets versus teaching in the 150, any student he taught in the J3 Cub without the headset soloed sooner than the student in the Cessna 150 that had headsets. Now, that's a fascinating thing to think about. And the thing there that's important to keep in mind is that the reason he surmised was that with the headset on, you could talk your student into a distracted frenzy and delay the process of learning to land. Whereas without headsets, typically as an instructor, you're using hand signals in order to convey what they should do. You're not talking very much, and you distract the student much less. Now, that is something to think about. Again, this is not a formal study, but that comports with my experience having taught starting in the 1973 without headsets. And it was relatively easy to solo a student in around 12 to 14 hours in your typical Piper Cub, L2, Cessna 150. And then with the advent of headsets, that tended to be delayed. And I think the reason is we distract our students in the process of their learning to land. And what that means for the flight instructor is, talk when you need to, but don't talk more than you need to. So my question for you starting off is this. If you had to describe the single biggest problem with students learning to land, what would that be? And you may say, well, it's learning the landing flare. Perhaps you'll say it's a well, it's a matter of getting the student comfortable with the airplane. It's a matter of, let's say, the roundout. It's a matter of learning basic stick and rudder coordination, what have you. Well, that question was answered by Wolfgang Langevecchia back in 1944. Take a look at this. And this happened, Stick and Rudder was published early World War XI. No, that's World War II. And what Langevecchia found was in Chapter 11, the very first page on Chapter 11 spells it out quite clearly. What he said was the airplane needs no rudder pedals. It should have no rudder pedals. In all probability, it will have no rudder pedals in 10 years. Hence, that's a fascinating statement to have read in Stick and Rudder, and it's one that most people just pass over. If you look at the bottom highlighted section, it says, as you might expect, there's a connection between the fact that rudder control ought not to be on the airplane at all and the fact that pilots have so much trouble using it correctly is because it's there. So Langevecchia said, rudder's the problem. And he's absolutely correct. And I intend to prove that to you. And I'm going to prove it to you this way. I get so excited talking about this. It's so much fun. And it's so interesting as an exploration into how people learn and how people sometimes learn inefficiently or are distracted from learning. And that's what this lecture is all about. Maybe you've seen the airplane before. It's called the AirCoop. It kind of looks like a mini constellation or baby constellation. And it's a fascinating airplane. It was created by Fred Wick in the late 1930s and early 1940s. It's one of my favorite airplanes forever. In fact, the J3 Cub is actually my most favorite airplane. This is the second. And it's the second most favorite airplane for one very important reason. I taught someone to fly in this airplane in minimum time, and brace yourself for impact here, because you're not going to believe this when I tell it to you, but I soloed him in 4.5 hours. 2 hours doing basic maneuvers and 2.5 hours in the traffic pattern. Think about this. This airplane, you cannot stall. It's a non-stallable airplane, has limited elevator travel. So you can mush it, but it doesn't stall. And if it doesn't stall, you can't spin it. So the reason for that is it doesn't have rudder pedals. The original Aircoupe design didn't have rudder pedals. You had rudder and aileron interconnects. And this is what Langevecia was talking about when he said, in 10 years hence, from 1944, airplanes will no longer have rudder pedals. In other words, he predicted, starting in 1944, when Langevecia's book was published, you can expect airplane rudder pedals to disappear, because the rudder and ailerons will be interconnected. And it's a brilliant concept. So you say, how do you land an airplane like this in a crosswind if you don't have rudder pedals? Well, you do it the way big jets do in many cases. Big jets that have engine pods that hang way below the wing, you can only do side slips, let's say, to land in correcting for a crosswind to a very limited degree in some of these bigger airplanes, primarily because you drag an engine pod. And it's a great way for, lighting up the runway at night with all those sparks, but it doesn't make the company happy. So in this case, you hold it in a crab angle, you drive it to the ground just like you're driving a car, hold your attitude, attitude plus power equals performance. In this case, so you're maintaining an attitude, maintaining an airspeed, you fly to, in a crab condition, and you do not kick out of the crab condition because there's no rudder to kick you out. What you have is flex gear on the airplane, and when you make contact with the ground, as long as the nose wheel is held above the ground, the airplane will align itself with the runway. And Fredwick said, and again, brace yourself for impact here, Fredwick said that when he soloed students, he would solo them in about 4.6 hours. So when I read that in a book, and again, I soloed my student in the Aircoupe here in the late 1970s, and I had never read from the ground up, but I did happen when I did read it, I was absolutely shocked to realize that Fredwick had the exact same experience. So let's take a look at this video, and this will explain it in a very succinct way. I have many videos on landings, and this is a short excerpt from one of them. No doubt you've heard this sad tale before. 40 hours of dual instruction with over 200 log landings, and Bobby still can't land an airplane. Bobby's in such despair that his instructor resorts to special motivational phrases to buoy his students' spirits. Okay, Bobby, not bad. You're missing the runway closer now. Oy vey. Why would someone with over 200 landings be unable to land an airplane? Now, if we assume average intelligence and reflexes fast enough to avoid an onrushing glacier, learning to land shouldn't be difficult at all. So what's going on here? Well, let me explain by taking you back in time, perhaps about 79 years. You see, in 1940, the Civil Aeronautics Administration, the CAA, conducted an experiment to determine the average time required for zero-time students ranging in age from 18 to 46 years to solo an airplane. Now, these students came from all walks of life and were divided into two groups. One group trained in a Piper Cub having conventional gear, conventional for that time period. The other trained in Fred Wick's recently created Aircoupe. Now, the Aircoupe was the first small airplane to have unconventional or tricycle gear, which was unconventional for the time. It also had a two-axis control system, in other words, no rudder pedals, that coordinated both rudder and aileron movement. The CAA experiment revealed that students training in the Piper Cub, the tail dragger, took approximately 8 hours to solo, while those training in the Air Coupe soloed in 4.3 hours. One student even soloed in 2.2 hours in the Air Coupe. Now, years ago, I soloed a student, zero-time student, in an Air Coupe in 4.5 hours at a tower-controlled airport. Apparently, when rudder pedals weren't needed to fly an airplane, learning to fly became amazingly easy. And the results of this experiment even motivated the CAA at that time to reduce the private pilot certificate requirements in a two-axis control airplane from 32 to 25 hours. Of course, you might argue that a tail dragger is certainly more challenging to land than a tricycle-geared airplane, and that's true. However, until the main wheels of both types of landing gear touch the runway, the control inputs required to round out and flare either airplane are essentially the same, assuming you touch down close to stall speed. And that is a very good example of how the Air Coupe can be soloed in 2.5 hours. And the whole point of that video was to show that rudders are the issue. Rudders are the problem here. And the point I want to make to you is that if rudders are the problem, how do we overcome that? And probably the single most important thing any instructor can do in order to prepare their student to land an airplane is to make sure that the first 6 hours of flight time that you're spending with a student are spent emphasizing the basics. I mean, attitude, you select the attitude, the power, and then you trim the airplane for the condition that you want. Being able to take an airplane and set it up for a glide at, let's say, 1.4 times VSO, that's 70 knots, and a Cessna 152, and then turning final and slowing the airplane down to 60, 65 knots, again, attitude, power, and trim. And being able to do that reflexively is essential to being able to effectively land an airplane. And being able to keep the airplane nose pointed or aligned with the runway in a no-wind condition and keep the wings level is absolutely essential. So in this instance, it's keeping the airplane coordinated so that during the entire approach to the airport, the nose does not wander off right and left. So keeping the wings level with the ailerons, the nose straight with the rudder, and the runway center line aligned with the student's right thigh bone. Because sometimes students have trouble aligning the airplane properly in that instance. And so what that does is it allows a student then to have, after 6 hours of being able to understand those fundamentals, that allows the student to be able to have the best chance of entering the landing environment and being able to learn to land quickly. Because what Fred Wick showed was the landing flare and the landing roundout really aren't the problem when you think about it. How can they be if a student can solo in 2.5 hours? And I found that with my student Vince, again, having soloed him in 4.5 hours, he was learning so fast. I'm thinking, how is he doing that? And then again, it's clear that students almost have a natural understanding about how to flare because they sit in a moving vehicle, otherwise known as a car, at what is typically approach speeds, 60 miles per hour, 70 miles per hour, or if you're a teenager, 95 miles per hour. And so you're able to look ahead and sense what your relationship is with the freeway you're driving on. You can see where the freeway stops. That's going to be called the sweet spot. I'll explain that in a second. And so that sitting height arrangement is not foreign to people that learn to fly airplanes, and they can bring that to the airplane. And clearly they do, as Fred Wick showed, in being able to solo an airplane in such a short period. Now, don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying that the emphasis is always on learning how to solo an airplane quickly. That's not the emphasis here. The emphasis on why people have trouble learning to land the airplane. So let's go ahead and take a look at our next video here. And I have a couple things. And by the way, if you want a good stick and rudder syllabus, these are available at my on my website. And let me go back here. I'm going to... Mike, are you still showing me sharing the screen here?
No, right now.
Okay, let me do that here. I'm going to share that. Oh, that screen. Okay, share too. Got it. Oh, stop share. Wrong one. This is a stick and rudder syllabus that's available. And I assume you can see that, Mike. Is that correct? This is available on my website, rodmachado.com. So, and they're free. But this is the stick and rudder syllabus that's very basic. It's a minimalist syllabus, but it contains everything you need essentially to prepare someone for the private pilot check ride, and it's free. So you can go to rodmachado.com, pick it up, and I also have IFR training syllabi there too. So feel free to help yourself. All right. Now, the other thing that really helps with students learning to land properly is the control grip. The first grip on the controls is the proper way to grip the controls. That's the grip on the left here. You see, it's a full hand grip, but it's not too tight. If you grip the controls too tight, what you do is you diminish your ability to be able to sense pressure change on the controls. Now, many instructors like to have their student grip the controls this way. I think I'm going to. Now, let me pick something else here. Highlighter. Yeah. Many students or instructors have their students pick a control grip like this that's just way too light. And the problem with that is you don't get enough sensory pad information. Your hand is full of sensory neurons, of course. And when you grip the control with a normal, proper control grip, that's the one, the far one on the left. What you end up with is a proper grip that gives the majority contact with your sensory nerve pads. This pad or this grip right here, you have minimal contact. So as a result, you have to grip too hard with the fingertips. And that's a problem because of something known as Weber's law. And what Weber's law says in terms of pressure, it takes a 16% change in pressure in order to detect that change. So if I'm holding the controls and I'm going to, and I feel a change in pressure because let's say I pulled the power off, the airplane needs to be trimmed and what have you, it's very difficult to sense small pressure changes, especially if the control grip is done with two fingers. It's much, much easier to sense pressure change with a proper control grip, as you see right here. So, and by the way, Weber's law is a fascinating thing to study. And I've written about this in my How to Fly an Airplane handbook. And if you wanted more information on it, also what really helps when it comes to teaching people to land properly and introducing them to landing is the location of the eyes in the seat. And this is sitting way too high here because the eyes are above the very top of the window pane here. This is sitting too low because the eyes are now probably below the top of the panel. And of course, that makes it difficult to see. And this is the perfect sitting height, about a half inch below the top of that panel. So you have to make sure you select the right sitting height, and you can do that if your seat doesn't have a vertical adjustment here by using the proper number of cushions. And sometimes you just need a cushion to raise you up here, or sometimes you need a cushion to raise you up and move you forward. And sometimes you need rudder pedal extenders in order to be able to reach the rudder pedals. One of my students came out for flying lessons many years ago. She already had 30 hours of flying time. Her name was Grace. Grace was 4 foot 6 inches tall. She was not very tall. And she had 30 hours of flying time, had not soloed. She had a very strange instructor, I might add, and a bit more on him shortly. But what happened was Grace was a heck of an instrument pilot. She could really fly instruments well because she could. Always, she was always watching the instruments. I guess she had to call the tower and have the tower tell her when she was lined up, basically because she couldn't see over the panel. So she showed up and I said, "Grace, where is your cushion?" She said, "I don't have a cushion." I said, "Your instructor didn't give you a cushion?" She said, "No." He said, "If I have a cushion, then what I'm not learning to fly properly because I may fly someday and not have a cushion." And I thought that is the most illogical thing I've ever heard, because once you learn to flare an airplane, you can actually reduce your seating height rather dramatically, and you still know how to flare. And therefore, you would make compensation for whatever visual cues you need in other ways. So it's a misunderstanding of the law of primacy, probably one of the most misunderstood rules in, or one of Thorndike's laws in all of aviation psychology. So cushions are very, very important. Now, the thing that's interesting about this, and this is how I've had great success teaching people to land, and that is all my landings initially for the first 2 or 3 hours are all done power off. And what I'll do is I will put the student initially in a position so that they can, again, we're assuming the traffic pattern will comply with this, and that's why I would normally start landings early in the morning rather than doing it in the afternoon, especially when the winds are more likely to be gusty in the afternoon, which doesn't aid the student in any way, shape, or form. But I'll start the student in the normal traffic pattern at a half mile to three quarter mile away from the runway laterally at the 45 degree point. And this is again about a half mile at the 45 degree point. Here, as the student turns to the left and looks and sees the runway threshold, here we'll go ahead and make the turn to base, reduce power, and establish the airplane at 1.4 times VS. And typically, I'll only use 10 degrees of flaps for the introduction, and I'll explain why in a second. And then we turn final and we establish the glide on final at 1.3 times VS. Now, these are speeds that we have trained for, again, with attitude, power, and trim in the practice area so the student can do them reflexively. This is a no-brainer, although the brain is still engaged, but the point is this, the student can do these reflexively. And if they can't do that, then they're suffering from the problem that Fred Wick, or I should say Wolfgang Lange-Visscher described, and that is problems with the rudder. So if they can fly coordinated, use rudder and aileron to keep the wings level and the nose from yawing when they keep those wings level, in other words, wings level, nose straight with the runway, no wind condition, they have the very best chance of being able to get acquired landing skill very, very quickly. And of course, if they're going to be low, I have them add power. If they're going to be high, then I may have them add more flaps. But in this case, I'm using the power fixed condition. And if the power is fixed, in other words, brought all the way back, there's no doubt what controls airspeed and what controls altitude. But keep in mind, I do this with a student when they're first learning to land. And when they go on for an instrument rating, they may change their pitch power technique. Again, it's a technique, it's not a procedure. The procedure is to control airspeed and altitude. The technique is your personal preference for what you need to control airspeed and altitude. And to date, there has been, I have not seen one study in 55 years of flying that indicated that using one technique over the other for advanced piloting is preferable. It's just up to you. It's personal. And the reason this is interesting to me is I remember talking to the lady who designed the training program for the Douglas Company, the C-17 training program. And I said, "How did you design that program?" And she said, "Well, Rod, what I did was I had to design two different programs, one for the Navy and one for the Air Force." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, the Navy, they control their altitude using the power and airspeed using the elevator control. And Air Force controls the airspeed with the power and the glide path with the elevator control." In other words, they have different techniques, Air Force and Navy, control of airspeed and altitude. And she said, "So I just trained them according to what they needed." And that sort of reinforces this idea that that's more of a technique rather than a procedure that you have to follow. But I use the power to control, well, altitude in this instance, and airspeed is controlled by the elevator control. And in this case, or glide path is controlled by the elevator. And the power is fixed in this condition, and it's the only option that you have. And again, if they're low, they would obviously add power. This also helps them develop the ability to assess their glide potential to the runway. Now, I also use only 10 degrees of flaps here when I do this. And let me explain why I do that. Hold on here. And I don't use full flaps when teaching them to land initially. That can be somewhat problematic here. Stand by for a second. Just have one little thing I need to do here to make this work. Okay, here we go. Nope. Stand by. I do apologize for this. I have to change the setting up.
I think you have to kill the spotlight. There's on the left-hand side a little arrow with something to get rid of because the spotlight is still selected. There you go. Something happened. Oh, we don't hear you. We see, but we don't hear.
Now, the reason I did no flap landings initially versus full flap landings is that the no flap landing, or that in this case, 10 degrees of flaps, gives you 7 seconds of extra time in the round out and flare. The full flap landing doesn't give you that. It just is over very quickly because, as you know, full flaps increase the drag and the airplane slows down very quickly. And you also have a steeper arc through which you need to flare. Rotate, in other words, to round out and flare. So I get much better performance doing it with 10 degrees of flaps versus no flaps. All right, let's continue on here. Let's take a look. And let's see here. We're going to go on here. And we won't do that. And okay, so the question now becomes, when do we begin the landing flare, the round out and flare? Watch this short video here, and this sort of explains. When do you begin the round out? It is beyond a doubt time to round out. You begin rounding out the airplane for landing when you're approximately 10 feet above the runway. Believe it or not, several million years of evolution have equipped you with a very functional 10-foot height detector. That's right, pilot, you come equipped with the necessary skills built in. One of our two basic instinctual fears is the fear of falling. Even a very young infant will shy away from a perceived edge of a precipice. We're pretty good at estimating the height from which a fall could really hurt, and those who couldn't do so were summarily dismissed from the gene pool a long time ago. It's not surprising that most of us who have survived can, just by looking, make a reasonable guess as to what a dangerous height is. Now, when it comes to landing, you can't look straight down at the ground out your left window because the ground will appear blurry and thus offer little or no surface detail with which to gauge your height. At a typical approach speed of around 50 to 60 knots, you can look 50 to 80 feet straight ahead during a descent and make a good guess as to when you're 10 to 15 feet above the ground. Couple your crude instinctual height evaluating skill with the fact that you've spent your life gauging your height above the surface by looking forward and slightly downward in the direction you're moving, and there's your prepackaged basic skills for getting a righteous round out reading. As you begin your round up by looking at a point on the runway 50 to 80 feet ahead of you, your ability to gauge your height above the landing surface is aided by, hopefully, a rich runway environment. The more sensory-rich the runway environment, the easier it will be to properly gauge the height for roundout. But every place isn't Hollywood or New York, so sometimes the airports you're landing at are just plain, which is a pain. No bells, no whistles, no thistles. The runway has few markings, or perhaps they've faded over time, and few surface clues. Maybe the rabbits ate all the bushes and the locals ate the rabbits, leaving the pilots to stew. Well, it's possible to compensate for this problem to some degree by having the tower activate the runway edge lighting or activating it manually to its highest setting if there is pilot-controlled lighting available. Because we see lighted objects better peripherally, this has helped some students to better gauge when to begin the round out for landing. And lights are not always available during the day, unfortunately. A year 2006 study conducted by the Australian Transportation Safety Board found that a rich runway foreground improves a student's ability to more accurately time the landing flare, in other words, estimate his or her height above the ground. Additionally, and this is very important, make sure you are not wearing polarized sunglasses during landing practice, which can reduce your visual input, especially in terms of the detail associated with the runway environment. One student in particular told me that the moment she removed her polarized glasses during landing training, suddenly she was better able to flare the airplane for landing. Now, that was a real game changer for me when it comes to this idea of being able to see the runway. And when I started having my students many years ago remove their sunglasses, and training early in the morning makes it easier to do, of course, they just had better visual acuity of the runway and better able to detect their height above the runway. You see, polarized glasses cut out the horizontal scattered light, but they also, with the tint, reduces 40% of the visual input. So I had no idea how detrimental that was. And glasses off, and it made a big difference in the student. And the student's ability to land. So these are essential cues. You know, using what the student brings with them in terms of driving a car, they have a good sense of how to measure their height above the ground. It tends to be almost a natural thing for them. And, you know, most people have an idea of what 10 feet is because that's the height on average that a person would feel threatened if they fell, let's say, from a ladder. Now, you probably wouldn't feel threatened if you fell from 5 feet. And of course, this does depend on your age. You know, let's face it, bathtubs are a hazardous event for people when they get older, and they should be declared a high risk element. In many cases, they are. But for younger people, you know, the idea of standing 10 feet on a ladder, they realize if they fell, they could possibly get hurt. And in fact, well, some people with acrophobia can't even get up on the ladder. But the point is that the idea of being 10 feet high is something that we tend to be almost instinctually able to assess. And therefore, looking 50 to 80 feet down the runway allows us to do that properly. Not looking out the left window, but 50 to 80 feet above the runway. Really. When do you... Now, here is something that is absolutely fascinating that also aids in helping a student learn when to begin the landing flare. This is an additional visual cue, and I want you to know it works in every single airplane that you might fly. And I've had testimonies from people that fly 747s, 757s, Tailorcraft L2s, L19s, Cessna 150, yada, yada, yada. I have yet to find an airplane this does not work in. So take a look at it and see what you think. First, if you're a student pilot who's beginning the landing phase of flight training, your flight instructor probably told you to look directly over the airplane's nose as you begin the landing flare, in other words, the round out and flare. So let's think about this. Place yourself on final approach, converging on a tiny runway lying flat on a large planet. As you begin the round out and the flare, the airplane's nose typically rises in your windscreen, blocking your view of everything ahead of you. Here's the problem. Your instructor might be providing you with a strategy that he or she uses to land an airplane without realizing that you might not have the perceptual skill to use that strategy. Consider this. When a flight instructor lands an airplane, he or she might indeed be looking directly over the airplane's nose, but he's not looking for what can't be seen, the runway. He can't see through the engine cowling despite his protestations otherwise. Now, what he can sense, at least to a degree, are details in the periphery. That's right. Your flight instructor is actually using peripheral clues to the right and left of the nose to gauge his or her height above the runway. Now, while peripheral vision doesn't expand as you gain more landing experience, you can learn to better perceive objects in your periphery with training. And that is exactly what your flight instructor has learned to use and come to rely on to land the airplane. He's learned to use his peripheral vision to aid in evaluating his height above and closure rate with the runway during the landing flare. Now, as a student pilot, you don't have the experience to do that. So you have to learn to use a different method at first to land because you're unable to use your peripheral vision in the way your flight instructor does. That's why student pilots should use the landing technique that I call the Find the Planet strategy. Here's how it works. As you begin the roundout, you should shift your visual focus to the left side of the engine cowling to a triangular-shaped viewing area bordered by the left side of the windscreen, the distant horizon, and the left side of the engine cowling. That's right. You can actually see the horizon to the left side of the engine cowling despite the fact that it disappears when looking directly over the airplane's nose during the landing flare. Amazing, right? The geometry of this area is shaped like a slice of pizza, which I call the domino effect, and in it, you'll see the left side of the runway as well as a small slice of the distant horizon. Congratulations, you've just found planet Earth again, evoking what I call the, hey, there it is response. Now, your job is to find, then look at a spot on the runway that appears to be stationary. It's the same spot you see ahead of you while driving on the freeway that just loses its blurry features and appears to become stationary because it's far enough ahead of you. Now, at most approach speeds in an airplane, this is typically located at about 80 to 100 feet ahead of the airplane. This non-moving, non-blurry spot allows you to assess your height above and vertical closure rate with the runway. Keep in mind that, perceptually speaking, the non-moving or non-blurry spot on the runway will shift towards you as the airplane slows down. Therefore, your runway focal point moves closer to the cockpit as the airplane decelerates during the landing flare. And this is how you accurately keep track of your height and closure rate with the runway. But there's another problem that most folks don't consider, and it involves their dominant eye. Now, your dominant eye is not the eye that browbeats the other eye, pun intended. It's the eye that you tend to rely on for precision visual measurement. Now, why is the dominant eye important when learning to land an airplane? Well, let's identify your dominant eye first, and then I'll explain why. Here's what I want you to do. Make a triangle with both index fingers and thumbs. No, this isn't the itsy bitsy spider, which actually starts out like this. And why I know that is deeply disturbing to me and perhaps to you too, but let's move on. Now, stretch your arms out in front of you and with both eyes open, move the center of the triangle to some small object at least 20 feet away. Now, what I want you to do is move that triangle towards your face while keeping that object centered in the triangle. And as you do that, do you see what's happening here? The triangle has come to rest over the dominant eye. And in my case, it's the right eye, which is not surprising since I'm right-handed. Since 85 to 90% of the population is right-handed, their right eye will typically be the dominant eye. And yes, there are exceptions, but we won't discuss these here. What does eye dominance mean to you when learning to land? Well, it means that you want to ensure that your dominant eye can at least see as much of the runway as your other eye. And that means doing more than a token neck twist to shift your vision to the left. Think about it this way. Baseball players with right eye dominance are taught to rotate their heads to the left a little more than normal when batting to better identify the trajectory, speed, and spin of the ball. If they rely primarily on their left non-dominant eye when batting, then they'll often be heard to say, "Hey, hey, where'd it go?" as the ball sneaks over the plate. So during roundout, when you shift your vision to the left to look through the slice of pizza, I really need you to shift your vision to the left. Now, don't be a sissy about it. Move it. Twist that head and shift your body to the left as necessary so that your right eye has the optimal view of the stationary spot on the runway. Don't worry. You won't fall out of the airplane. After all, you have your seatbelt on, and since you haven't paid the instructor yet, he will most likely grab you before you tumble out onto the runway. So you'll be surprised at how helpful this technique is when learning to land an airplane. So the runway expansion effect is coming up here, but the idea of knowing where to look when you flare is absolutely essential. I remember being out at UND many years ago. I was sitting with a gaggle of instructors, and I asked them, I said, "Where do you teach your students to look when you flare?" And every single one of them said, "Over the nose." And I said, "Really? It's very, very interesting. So what happens to the nose during the flare?" Well, the nose obviously comes up. And none of them had flown tail draggers, so they didn't have the tail dragger experience, which, of course, sits at a slightly higher angle during taxi and on landing. In other words, a higher pitch angle. You can't see over the nose, and that's why you have to serpentine to see what's to the right or left of you. And so I said, "Have you ever thought about looking off to the left in order to see through that pizza slice I just talked about to see where the runway is, the horizon, and the non-moving spot?" And none of them had ever been taught that or thought about that. And so it's a very common thing with students. Once you start using that that pizza slice method, that pie in the sky method, it makes a very, very big difference in terms of helping your students land better, because now they can actually see the runway. And that's that is very, very important. Okay, so let's continue on here. There's another idea, and I just mentioned it. I get so excited, I kind of jumped ahead here. And that is what is known as the runway expansion effect. And I want you to watch this video, and we'll talk about it. Here we go. Hello, folks. I'm Rob Machado for AOPA Live. What if I could show you how to identify when to begin the roundout and flare for landing in a way that doesn't rely on depth perception? Have I got your attention? Good. Let's discuss the technique that we'll call the runway expansion effect. As we learned in an earlier video, when you approach the runway in a stabilized descent, its trapezoidal shape appears to grow in the windscreen. The rate of growth, however, isn't linear. It turns out that the width of the runway near your selected landing spot appears to expand geometrically in the windscreen, with the largest amount of growth occurring when you're 8 to 10 seconds from touchdown. In fact, during the period from 12 seconds to 8 seconds prior to touchdown, the runway width at your selected landing spot appears to expand 10 times in size. Looking at the runway lateral expansion versus time to touchdown graph, you can see how the rate of runway expansion is the largest when you are 8 to 10 seconds away from touching down. And this expansion also occurs at a point where the airplane is typically around 10 feet above the landing surface. Said another way, the runway dramatically widens in your windscreen right at the point where you should typically begin the roundout, followed by the landing flare. Now that is very convenient. So here's how to use the sudden lateral expansion of the runway in your windscreen. If we assume that you're making a stabilized approach at no more than 30% above your airplane's present stall speed, and that's very important, then the moment you notice the runway's width expanding, you should pull your power to flight idle, raise the nose level with the runway. Then, as you start to settle, you'll further raise the nose and put the top of the cowling on the distant horizon and continue pulling aft on the elevator to keep it there. Let's see how this looks from the air. Here's a stabilized approach at 30% above the airplane's present stalling speed. We're aiming to touch down in the center of the first third of the runway. Watch for the point where the runway width suddenly expands. There it is. Now reduce any power to idle, raise the nose level with the runway, and when you begin to settle, put the top of the cowling on the horizon and hold it there. Touchdown. And right on the runway center line too, even without having to call the tower and having him activate the runway centerline widening device. There's no such thing, unfortunately. Now watch this expansion sequence one more time. Wait for it. Wait for it. There it is. So when might you use this technique? Well, I find it very valuable when landing at night. After all, you have fewer sensory clues at night, and this often requires that you place more emphasis on the runway's edge lighting, which makes it very easy to identify the sudden lateral expansion of the runway. You might also find the technique useful when landing an unfamiliar airplane, such as during a checkout. This is an airplane where you really haven't developed a feel for this particular machine. Finally, if you're a student pilot having trouble identifying where to begin the roundout and what student pilot doesn't, this strategy could help. But here's the caveat. This technique requires that you have the skill to fly a stabilized approach at no faster than 30% above the airplane's present stall speed. At this speed, you're very close to the bottom of the airplane's total drag curve. And that means as you flare, the induced drag will increase and slow the airplane down for landing. At speeds higher than this, you're likely to float during the roundout, and that's never a good thing. So keep in mind that this is a very general technique and somewhat mechanical, but it works in most instances in smaller airplanes. Try it out for yourself. Folks, I sure enjoy taking you flying.
Okay, great. And this is what you see right here in about 2 seconds, the actual expansion of the runway here. From here at 12 seconds and to 10 seconds right here, a dramatic expansion. And this is where you begin actual landing roundout and flare, and then, you know, transition that into the flare. It's a consistent phenomenon. It's really quite amazing to watch once you notice it. And by the way, I also have my students use their flight simulator to practice this at home. And what you do is you set the flight sim up at this position here. This is about a quarter mile from the runway. You can set it up at about a half mile from the runway at about 250 feet, but this works just fine. And you save this particular flight, and then you can always restart it and practice it, you know, like 30 times in a half hour. It's really interesting to do and great practice for the student. Watch this. No sound here. And the sound is actually me. And there's the expansion right there. There's the roundout and flare and touchdown. And then I'll go ahead and hit the, I've programmed it, so I click the Z key. It returns me back to the original saved flight. And then I will go ahead and move the cockpit, the 3D cockpit, up to where I want it. I push the pause key, move the cockpit forward, and then move my sitting height upward. And then click the pause key again, and I can repeat the same action over and over and over again. And you can do this with crosswind landings. You can do this just practicing the landing roundout and flare. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. Great experience for the student. Okay, let's just continue on here. A few more things here that I want to show you. Just have two more slides. Actually, I have, and the landing flare exercise, I might as well show you this here too. Let me go ahead and click this off. And I know I'm...
The ultimate training exercise for learning the landing flare. Here's a wonderful training exercise that you can do with a competent and capable flight instructor on board that will help you calibrate your rearward pull on the elevator control during the flare.
Under your instructor's supervision, approach the runway with no more than 10 to 15 degrees of flaps at a speed of 1.3 times VS, 30% above stall speed. As the airplane reaches a height of 10 to 15 feet above the runway, simultaneously raise the nose and apply sufficient power to hold 10 to 15 feet of altitude at 1.3 times VS. Your objective here is to track the runway centerline at approach speed while holding altitude. At first, this will be quite challenging simply because you'll have no idea what type of pitch response results from the pressure you apply to the elevator.
Okay, that's the exercise that's worth practicing here. And you have to be very careful with your students to not let the airspeed decay below a safe control speed. But this is a wonderful exercise. And you just tell the tower what you're doing so they don't get excited when they see your airplane hyper-floating down the runway. And Mike, do I have time for one more video? It's about 3 minutes long.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, this is really good. This video right here is called Sampling the Response, and it is the one thing that'll take your students' ability to round out and flare over the edge. So here we go. And this normally kind of shakes people up, but this is what pilots do, and they don't even, experienced pilots do, and they don't even realize they're doing it, and I'll prove that to you. And it's an excellent technique for learning to land.
Sampling the response. Keep in mind that during the roundout and flare, the ideal landing technique is one where you pull back consistently and smoothly on the elevator as the airplane approaches the ground at ever-decreasing descent rates until the main gear wheels gently squeak onto the runway, and the squeak being made by the wheels and not the pilot's tiny biceps. This ideal rate of aft elevator application is a continuous aft pull on the elevator. There is, however, a very interesting technique that experienced pilots use to help them maintain the precise elevator back pressure necessary to produce a smooth landing. Known as sampling the response, this technique allows them to precisely control the airplane's rate of closure with the runway, thereby minimizing the chance of over or under flaring the airplane. Here's how it's done. During the flare, apply continuous elevator back pressure, but do so in small pull and release motions. Think about pulling just far enough aft so that the nose would begin to rise beyond the desired pitch attitude if you pulled even a tiny bit more. As you hold the elevator in this position, you've technically arrived at a point that I call the threshold of control, a point at which pulling further would raise the nose. But as we've just discussed, this threshold is always moving elevator aft as you slow down. So you have to keep sampling the elevator response to maintain that threshold of control. It's the constant recalibration of an aft moving elevator resulting from this pull-release type motion that allows you to make the airplane's nose stay right where you want it to stay and lets you retain immediate control of the airplane's attitude. This means that the airplane's nose shouldn't unexpectedly pitch forward or downward during the landing flare. Now, you'd think that the airplane would be jumping up and down like one of those mechanical bulls in a Texas bar. The pull-release motions, however, are small enough, and if they're done correctly, they're small enough, that no one in the cockpit will feel any vertical pitch acceleration, nor will anyone inside or outside the cockpit see the nose pitching or moving up and down. You will see the elevator control being moved aft with small pull and release motions during its travel. These motions are more visible on larger single-engine airplanes, where the airplane's mass requires a larger displacement of the elevator to change the pitch slightly. The proper application of this technique requires proportionately smaller forward and aft yoke movements to remain in the threshold of immediate control when flying airplanes in the weight class of a Cessna 150 or a J3 Piper Cub. It's worth trying this technique on a few landings to see if it gives you a better idea of how to flare your airplane.
it's certainly ideal to apply one continuous increasing pull on the elevator during the landing, and you should always strive for the ideal. On the other hand, some folks have a difficult time flaring that way. So be it. Now, here are two examples of pilots using the threshold of control to make very smooth full stall landings. Watch the yoke move back and forth slightly during the roundout and the flare. And there you go, folks. The point here is that the ideal method of controlling the airplane during the flare is a continuous pullback. But realistically, if you watch anybody land an airplane, 9 out of 10 people don't do that because it's just not a realistic way to be able to precisely control the nose of the airplane. So with that in mind, I hope some of these things have been useful to you and things you can use. And if you want to read more about them, I've written 8 books. One of them is How to Fly an Airplane. I have quite a few digital courses at my website, rodmachado.com. I offer a 25% discount for the products at my website, and that would be, for all caps, BOOTCAMP, BOOTCAMP, BOOTCAMP. That's for a 25% discount for the next week. BOOTCAMP, Boot Camp. And I want to thank you so much for being with me. Mike, thank you so much for having me. So I will open it up to questions if anybody has any questions now. And I'd love to stay and chit-chat with you.
Bootcamp in Miami Beach, Florida. This is the Power Hour. Welcome.